Sometimes his nightmares were so savage it sounded like he was being murdered. She saw how Adam avoided going out, especially into crowds. Even walks in the woods behind the house were an ordeal. Everywhere he went, he was scouring the ground for IEDs. At least he had started going running with her. Well, more like she followed Adam as he sprinted. Poor kid could easily outrun her, but not his demons. The hope she saw in Dr. Finley's eyes, the enthusiasm in his words, buoyed Carrie's commitment. Dr. Finley had told her about the program after she had accepted the position, but seeing everyone else respond with excitement reinforced her own enthusiasm. She was proud to be on the cutting edge of such critical care. Funny that she'd named her goldfish Limbic, the system the amygdala resided in. Was fate at work here? Chapter 16. The operating room was Carrie's amphitheater, and she was the violinist about to dazzle. She was back in uniform, green scrubs underneath a white lab coat. Soon, she would enter the preoperative holding area to visit a patient, her first at the VA. His would be the first burr hole she would drill in almost 2 months. Jealousy from the other resident physicians had been an initial worry. Other residents had competed for their positions, while Carrie had been handed what many would perceive as a post-resident fellowship, working directly with one attending on a single project without the onerous responsibilities of taking call or being responsible for patient care. It was a plum assignment, for sure, but Dr. Finley made it clear to everyone that Carrie would not receive credit toward her residency requirements. No, this was a different trial for her. Would she perform to her ability? While the DBS procedure she would perform would be relatively simple and straightforward, it was by no means free of complications. Opening the brain involved significant, life-threatening risks every time. Still, implanting wires was not like sucking out blood clots deep in an already swollen brain where the surgeon had to be both swift and meticulous. DBS required a tremendous amount of patience and an OCD-like attention to detail. Carrie took a few calming breaths. She ought to wait for Dr. Kaufman, the anesthesiologist, but she felt she could handle the preoperative consultation just fine. 5 minutes later, Carrie entered the preoperative holding area, where she was struck by the sight of a man who could have been her brother's twin. Seated on a beige armchair, reclined ever so slightly, the man looked like Adam not before the war, but after. He had Adam's strong jaw and sharp-featured face, but his shaved head called attention to his concave cheeks, and he appeared frail and skeletal. His arms were spotted with ugly purple bruises that spiraled outward like mini nebulas. But it was the eyes that truly alarmed her. They looked hollow, a stare that seemed to stretch out into space. Carrie was not sure what to expect from patients after they'd been subjected to the virtual reality therapy, but it certainly was not this. Her patient had the dazed look of a car accident victim. She knew he would be sedated, but it was tough to see his suffering. Carrie usually treated the sorts of injuries and ailments that appeared on an MRI. This man's wounds were just as significant, even if they couldn't be imaged. She checked her chart. She knew the soldier's name, but wanted to double-check to make sure she got it right. Her father's lessons on the importance of details had taken root.
Abington, Staff Sergeant Steve Abington.
Carrie helped Abington out of the chair and onto the exam table, positioned kitty corner in one end of the room near a counter with a built-in sink. Above the sink was a steel medical supply cabinet affixed to the wall. At first, Carrie thought Abington was too thin, but once he was standing, she could see he was rippled with muscle. He had the minimal body fat of an athlete.
How are you doing today, Steve?
No response. Abington had fixed his gaze on the framed print of the Boston Common on the wall before him, but he seemed to be looking through it, not at it. Carrie was close enough to smell detergent and cleanser. He smelled institutionally clean. She checked her chart again. No address listed, no emergency contacts. He could have been homeless and now in the care of the VA system. What did they use for soap where he lived? I'm the surgeon who is going to perform your DBS procedure today. I wanted to meet you before the operation in case you had any questions for me. Do you have any questions, Steve? Abington turned his head slowly, dreamlike, as though pushing through molasses.
His mouth began to twitch, perhaps to form a word, but all that came out was a guttural noise like the clearing of a throat. Carrie knew that the DBS had to be done within a window of opportunity immediately following the virtual reality simulation, when the negative memory was most fresh in the mind. She did not know exactly where DARPA conducted the simulations, or who had escorted Abington to the exam room, or where that person had gone. Those questions were well outside of her area of responsibility.
"There are lots of bruises on your arms, Steve. Can you tell me how you got them?"
Abington shifted his gaze to one of his battered arms. He lifted the limb slowly, like a marionette whose string was pulled, and studied the arm with detached, vague curiosity. Then his face slipped back into that dead-eyed gaze. Carrie moved to check his vitals, and he did not resist. Blood pressure, 90 over 60, perfectly normal. His temperature was 98.6 degrees, and his reflexes were normal. Heart rate was also in normal range for a resting adult. She put a penlight up to his eyes, 5-millimeter pupils, a bit dilated, but equal, and briskly reactive to the flashlight.
Good.
All the consent forms had been signed. There was no reason not to proceed with the surgery.
Steve, do you understand what's going to happen? You're scheduled for a very important operation.
Once again, Abington's mouth began to twitch with words he could not quite form. Then, surprisingly, he started to move his body, bouncing where he sat like an anxious child, and massaging the bruises on his arms. To Carrie, it looked as though his drained battery had somehow sparked back to life.
"You don't know. You don't know,"
Abington mumbled. He periodically stopped rubbing to run his fingers over his newly shaved pate.
"What don't I know?" Carrie asked.
"I don't belong here."
"I know you're scared, Steve, but we're here to help."
Abington shook that off.
"It's not all right. I don't belong here."
His voice rose in pitch and volume.
"You don't know."
"Steve, take it easy."
Abington went still. His arms dropped to his lap. Carrie let out a relieved breath, wishing that she'd waited for Dr. Finley or Dr. Kaufman before starting the consultation. Dr. Finley had warned her that patients could be highly agitated pre-op. They were fragile following the virtual reality treatment.
"Steve, let me explain what..."
Abington reached out and seized her by the throat, pressing on her windpipe. Shocked, Carrie started to panic, her eyes bugging out, able to take only tiny gasps of air. She reeled backward, pulling Abington off the exam table. As he dropped to the floor, Abington let go of her throat, so Carrie whirled around and sprang for the door. But Abington charged her. With speed that belied his earlier torpor, he snatched the back of Carrie's flapping lab coat just as she was within reach of the door handle. He pulled her toward him and she fell back into his arms. Then he spun Carrie around to face him. His mouth formed a fearsome snarl, from lifeless to rabid in a matter of moments. His sedative must have worn off, revealing murder in his eyes.
"I don't belong here," he hissed in her face. "Got to get out."
His back was to the door she had closed for their interview, and hers was to the counter and medicine cabinet. Carrie wriggled free from Abington's grasp.
"Somebody, please help me,"
Carrie yelled, though it was doubtful anyone would hear her. The walls were made of thick concrete, and the nurse's station was located way down the hall. Carrie flashed on an idea and turned her back to Abington to focus on the locked supply cabinet.
"Help!" Carrie cried out again. "Somebody, help!"
From behind, Carrie heard Abington gibber unintelligibly. Carrie fumbled in her pocket for the keys. Did she dare risk turning her head? She could not resist. Abington paced in front of the door like a caged animal. He took a step toward Carrie and said,
"I'm not here. I don't belong here."
He could have left the room, but he wanted something else. He wanted her. Carrie retrieved the keys, but her hand shook so violently it could be impossible to work the lock.
"Which key opens the damn cabinet anyway?"
Carrie fumbled with the keys some more. There were too many attached to the ring. She heard Abington take another step toward her. One single step. Carrie's throat ached where he had grabbed her. The soldier's labored breath seemed to come from every corner of the room. Carrie located a small key among the jumble on her ring and tried to jam it into the lock. No good. Wrong fit. She searched for another. The cabinet was made of metal, otherwise she would have broken the glass.
Help! Carrie yelled.
There was another small key on the ring, but was it the same one she had just tried?
Abington muttered, "Listen to me. I don't belong here."
Carrie jammed the second key into the lock, and this time it fit. The lock turned easily, and Carrie ripped open the door. Mixed in with a number of medical supplies, she found various vials of medication and several wrapped syringes.
"I don't belong here,"
Abington said from someplace behind her. Carrie fumbled through many vials of medicine until she found the Valium. She held the Valium in one hand and used her teeth to rip open a syringe package. Carrie kept her back to Abington as she worked to get the syringe inserted into the top of the vial.
"Steve, it's okay. You're going to be okay. Please, believe me. I'm going to give you a shot to calm you down."
Carrie filled the syringe just as Abington charged and struck her in the back. His momentum slammed Carrie against the lip of the counter hard enough to take her breath away. Abington wrapped his arms around her waist, and together they tumbled to the floor. Carrie held onto the syringe with her life. She twisted underneath him, intending to claw at his face, but Abington flipped her onto her back and dug his knees into her ribs hard enough she feared he'd snap her sternum. Once again, Abington took hold of Carrie's throat, but this time he did not squeeze.
"Where's Smokes? Hunter? Is Hunter here? What about Roach?"
His voice was plaintive.
"Roach?"
Carrie forced herself to stop struggling. "Just don't squeeze, please. Don't squeeze." Years of surgery gave Carrie tremendous hand dexterity. She was able to position the syringe for an effective strike without drawing Abington's attention.
"Please, Steve. I'm not here to hurt you."
"That you, Roach?"
Abington said.
"You gotta get me out of here. I don't belong."
Abington tightened his grip around Carrie's throat like a python readying to squeeze. She had one chance. One. It was hard to hit under normal circumstances, but induction time was everything. The drug needed to work and work fast. Abington squeezed some more. Carrie could still get air into her lungs, but it was barely a breath. Gurgling noises bubbled up from her throat from all the saliva that had no place to go.
One chance. One.
Abington's jugular vein pulsed like a thick blue target. Carrie swung her arm in a wide arc. Abington leaned away from the strike, and his body position shifted. Instead of hitting his neck, Carrie slammed the needle into Abington's shoulder, right into the muscle. It would delay induction, but she depressed the plunger anyway. Carrie tried to speak, but no words came out. She left the syringe dangling in Abington's arm and used her fingers to try and pry Abington's hands free. Abington acted unfazed. He pressed harder on Carrie's throat. The loss of oxygen started to get to her, and she couldn't control her panic. She kicked and bucked wildly, but could not toss him. Her legs began to spasm and her eyes watered.
"This isn't how I'm supposed to die."
Gripped by panic, Carrie thrashed beneath Abington, kicking over a metal stool that clattered noisily to the floor, but it was no use. He would not let go. She felt herself slip into unconsciousness. Her body became heavy, Novocaine for blood. Carrie closed her eyes. She did not want the last thing she'd see to be the face of her murderer. And then she was filled with a sense of profound peace, of weightlessness. She felt her fear fall away as the darkness grew deeper and darker. In the very next moment, Carrie could breathe again, and the room went from dark to bright. The feeling of weightlessness slipped away as she blinked her eyes open. Dr. Finley knelt beside her. He looked as worried as her father might.
"Carrie, are you okay? Can you hear me?"
Through her blurred vision, Carrie saw Dr. Kaufman and a sizable orderly restraining Abington. Chapter 17. David Hoffman carried two drinks over to the table where Adam Bryant sat waiting. The young veteran had called unexpectedly and invited him to coffee in Hopkinton, so David, worried that Adam could easily return to his shell, canceled his plans with Gabby and Emma. David didn't like to disappoint Gabby, but he'd bring her to the Children's Museum some other day.
"You take it black, right?"
David said, setting down a steaming mug. Adam took a sip in response.
Usually I drink tea these days, the chosen beverage of the Afghan people. But for whatever reason, I'm in the mood for a good cup of joe.
David had shown up 15 minutes early and found Adam already there, his jean jacket and faded t-shirt fitting the coffee shop's bohemian vibe. Adam's darting eyes and alert posture told David he'd chosen their seats deliberately, with the best sight lines and quick access to the exit. Adam's training and caution had kept him alive during the war. His body might be thousands of miles from Afghan soil, but certain instincts remained. David settled in his comfy chair with his espresso. Compared to the stuff they served in the Middle East, this coffee tasted like water. He thought he'd had a shot at a Reuters job that would send him to Saudi Arabia, but evidently his reputation still preceded him. David knew he would get back in those good graces eventually, so the setback was not overly discouraging. Besides, his story on PTSD was too important to rush. He wanted to tell it right, and Adam's perspective would help.
"I'm glad you called," David said. "I didn't think you would." "Yeah," Adam replied. "I wasn't sure myself. Figured at least I owed you was an apology."
"You don't owe me anything, Adam. I just want to get your story out there, if you're willing to share."
Adam inspected David's face.
"Nose looks pretty good," he said. "Look, I'm really sorry I lost my cool. I was pushy. I asked for it."
Adam didn't disagree.
"Do you mind if I take notes?" David asked.
"No, man, you gotta get it right."
David took out his pen and pad.
"So, how do you want to begin?"
"I'm not sure.
Hard to say what got me all screwed up."
"You mean there wasn't a specific incident?"
The corners of Adam's mouth ticked up a couple degrees into the hint of a smile.
"It was all a specific incident, man."
"Start wherever you'd like. Whatever feels natural."
David acted as if they had all the time in the world. If Adam had been privy to the terse conversation David had had with Annika on his drive to Hopkinton, he would know that this was not the case. She continued to hound David for the story, and he continued to come up with appropriate delay tactics. So far, he had interviewed the two other vets he'd mentioned to Annika, spoken with an administrator at Walter Reed, networked with a retired brigadier general, and read several books on PTSD that covered everything from science to sociology. The books were enlightening, but they could not adequately convey the depth of pain David saw in Adam's eyes. Adam seemed lost for words.
"What was it like for you over there?" David said. "How about describing a typical day?"
Adam thought. "Well, I guess on a typical day, you do PT from 0530, and it could go until the CO wanted to puke. Most of the time, it was just an hour, though. A PT, that's physical training."
"Got the reference, but thanks."
Adam said, "Then his SSS, that's shower, shit, shave, before breakfast, just the normal stuff. A lot of time, it was real quiet, you know? Funny, because the quiet was the toughest part. It gave you time and space to think about stuff, home, all the things you missed. But mostly you focused on your friend who got blown up the other day. You had time to think that you were going out on patrol soon, and maybe you'd get blowed up yourself."
Adam put the words "blowed up" inside air quotes.
"Basically, that was life. It was patrol and post," he continued. "We'd go out 4 or 5 hours in the morning, come back and eat something, then go back on patrol. And then you'd have dinner and maybe do another patrol after that. Or sometimes you go out on patrol and some T-man is shooting your ass up. Or sometimes you didn't come back."
David guessed T-man meant Taliban. He would check later, as he did not want to interrupt Adam's flow.
"You can come back from patrol so racked up," Adam said. "Good luck getting any sleep. And then before you know it, you got PT all over again, and then boom, you're back on patrol, same as the day before. It's Groundhog Day over there."
"Even the firefights?"
"Yeah, well, that's the only break in routine. But on a COP, even that becomes routine, you know?"
David nodded as he jotted down the word COP in his notebook, something else to look up.
Can you tell me about one of the patrols where things did not go well?
Watching Adam, David was reminded of friends who had embedded with U.S. forces in Iraq and Afghanistan and got shot at or navigated an IED, or worse, did not, and who all came back haunted. David did not believe in ghosts, and his religious views bordered on agnostic. But those who came back often seemed burdened by a malevolent spirit that would not let them find peace. Adam's expression shifted, like a shadow that crossed his face, as he seemed to settle on a particularly unpleasant memory.
On my last tour, we set up a COP in an abandoned school.
Adam's voice turned softer.
A COP is a combat outpost, in case you were wondering.
David made a note next to the abbreviation in his notebook.
We were sleeping on cots, with our guns and packs tossed around like a bunch of school kids on a camping trip, Adam said. The air there never circulated. It was so damn hot at night, it was like sleeping in a sauna. The only breeze you'd catch is if the guy next to you cut wind, but you know the drill, right? Patrol and post, David said.
Adam looked pleased.
So, I'm on patrol. The day before, we had some T-men shooting at us, and some kids from the village said they knew where they were. For $10 and a few Twix bars, you can get all sorts of good intel from the locals. We took two fire teams out on a hunting expedition. We got an AK, RPK, RPG, lots of firepower with us. Going to get us some T-men.
Adam's leg began to bounce, fast enough to shake the table. David kept his eyes on Adam while he silently moved their drinks to an adjacent table to avoid a spill.
So we're following these kids on some shitty nothing road.
Adam's voice gained energy with the telling.
Moving west to east. The whole time I'm looking for upturned dirt. You see, pre-deployment training teaches you that upturned dirt could mean an IED. But let me tell you, the dirt's upturned everywhere you look. Everywhere. So any step could be it. Boom. Any single step.
It was cool inside the coffee shop, but a sheen of sweat coated Adam's forehead. His eyes darted in all directions as though he were scanning the tiled floor in search of upturned dirt.
Adam said, by the time we reach the village, we're all sorts of jacked. And most of the kids we're following go on back to their little mud huts. Of course, villagers come out to greet us, but it's hard to know which are allies and which are Taliban. Now, in addition to IEDs, we're keeping eyes out for guns poking out of robes because rules of engagement say we can't shoot anybody who's unarmed. But it's a kinetic area, violent, I mean. You just don't know who's there to kill you and who wants to help. It's a constant Charlie Foxtrot. That would be clusterfuck in your vernacular.
Adam reached for his coffee and took a long drink, then returned it to the adjacent table. David could relate distantly to Adam's ordeal, having been in some dicey situations of his own. But what Adam had endured was on a different level. The idea that any step could be one's last was truly terrifying. David could not see how anybody could return from that sort of grinding stress unchanged.
So, we're back moving, with just one guide now. A 12-year-old kid, maybe 14. He's skinny and dirty and waving frantically for us to hurry.
Adam waved his arms, pantomiming the kid's gestures. His breath turned shallow.
He points to these trees, maybe 100 meters away, just past the outskirts of the village. Hell, even the trees are brown over there. Sometimes when I get stressed, I have to look at something green to remind myself where I am.
Adam paused to gaze out the window at the green of Hopkinton, but when he looked back, he did not appear convinced he was safe.
Anyway, we follow this kid a bit further down the road, but every step, you know, we're doing our check. Upturned dirt. And then, the kid turns around and he just smiles at us. I'll never forget that look on his face. It was pure joy. And then he reaches into his robe, takes out a pistol, and he fires. PFC O'Malley is right there in front, and he takes the bullet in the side. Damn kid gets this lucky shot. Bullet doesn't even nick O'Malley's SAPI plate.
Adam was breathing harder now. His eyes darted about, seeing phantoms everywhere. The sweat on his forehead began to drip down his face, as if he was back in the Afghani heat.
A couple guys jump on O'Malley right away, but I'm focused on the kid.
He fires again, but we're all moving now, so he doesn't get a clean shot, and now I've got good lines on him. My AK is up, and I get off a burst. Rat-tat-tat.
Adam raised his hands as if he was holding his gun. He trained the imaginary weapons on patrons at the coffee shop. A few noticed and flinched in response. Adam's voice choked with raw emotion, and he sucked down air in gulps.
I ripped him apart, you know?
Tears streamed down Adam's face. He wiped them away with the back of his hand.
I fucking tore this kid in half. Pink mist everywhere. And we're all scrambling for cover, thinking T-men are right there, and now it's an ambush. But there weren't any T-men. Just IEDs all over the side of the road. The kid knew he was gonna die. He just wanted us to scamper, to be careless.
With the tears, the sweat, the snot, Adam was clearly reliving the moment, as he probably did most every night in his nightmares.
Sure enough, I heard the boom, and then another, and then somebody's arm hit me in the face. There were limbs everywhere, man. Fucking flying everywhere. Bodies aren't supposed to be blown apart like that. Blood and limbs and guts everywhere you looked.
David's heart was racing now as well.
So we're all over it, you know? Fix our wounded, fix them. Four things, restore the breathing, stop the bleeding, protect the wound, treat for shock. We got this quick clot shit, and I can see Doc P working on O'Malley, using it like caulk on a leaky window. The blood's spurting out of him like a whale shoots water out of a blowhole. And I'm just looking around. My ears are ringing, it's like I'm underwater. And LT Carson is coming toward me, doing a commando crawl, but I can see his legs are blown off and he's dragging his intestines behind him.
Adam fell silent and bowed his head. When he looked up, his eyes were ringed and red, but the tears had stopped falling.
Bodies aren't meant to be broken apart that way.
Chapter 18. Steve Abington was breathing comfortably, 12 times each minute, heavily sedated, his oxygen delivered via an endotracheal tube. Just hours ago, he had been rabid, but now he looked peaceful, thanks to the combo of propofol and fentanyl, which the anesthesiologist, Dr. William Kaufman, titrated expertly. The patient was hooked to a ventilator as well as the usual monitors for ECG, blood pressure, and pulse oximetry. Abington's labs came back within normal limits. Still, he almost hadn't gotten to this operating table. The whole team had met for a lengthy discussion in the conference room down the hall from where Carrie had been attacked. For the first several minutes, Dr. Finley apologized profusely to Carrie for not having been clearer about security and safety measures. He promised a thorough review of all practices and standards and said he would have new protocols in place by the end of the week. In the meantime, there was the matter of Abington. This was a medical meeting, but Cal Trent from DARPA was present, along with Dr. Finley, Dr. Kaufman, and Carrie. Trent was dressed nattily in a tailored blue suit that showed off his muscular frame. At the Grand Rounds, she'd thought him cold and distant, but here he acted warm and conciliatory.
I'm really sorry for what happened to you,
Trent said in his low, gravelly voice.
You must still be very shaken.
I'm doing all right, Carrie replied, which was only a half-truth. She was shaken, but perfectly functional. She'd had a brief medical exam, and despite some bruising on her neck, she was unharmed and experiencing no shock. She had recovered her composure rapidly.
Timing here is everything, Dr. Finley said. Abington is active right now.
Active? Carrie asked.
He's been subjected to the VR simulation program. This is the time when those recreated memories are being enhanced emotionally by connections through the amygdala. The DBS has to block those emotional connections, and we'll lose our chance if the memory evaporates. It's not like PD, where we had the luxury of making subtle adjustments over weeks and months. There's no telling if the virtual reality would be effective again,
Trent added.
We don't have any data on this. But essentially, it could be a one-shot deal for him. If we don't get a DBS system installed and working, Abington might miss his only opportunity to lead a normal life.
Carrie, I want you to know it's up to you, Dr. Finley said.
Medically speaking, I see no reason not to proceed, but obviously we need our head surgeon to be at the top of her game.
All eyes fell on Carrie. She was starting to develop a conference room complex. The last time she'd been in one with all eyes on her like this, the conversation went horribly. And again, Carrie had an important decision to make. Should she go ahead with the procedure? Though the decision was hers, there was no mistaking what Dr. Finley and the rest of the team wanted her to choose. As for Abington, it was clear that the hyper-realistic virtual reality simulation had triggered his rage. Carrie felt deep empathy for her attacker and would not hold him accountable for his actions. But she wondered what he had seen during the simulation. Was Smokes there? Roach? What had happened to them over there? While Carrie had come to the VA to recover from a devastating professional setback of her own, this procedure might be a way to truly help people like Adam and Steve, whose minds and lives had been turned into a daily nightmare. Right now, Carrie was the only surgeon here. It was her job, and the window was fast closing. If DBS could ease Abington's grievous memories in a Don McCall miracle way, Carrie owed it to him to try. I'm fine to proceed. Let's do it. Carrie could not believe how natural it felt to be back in the OR. This was an environment where she could feel herself in control. The old adage of riding a bike was not lost on her. Unlike the vets whose PTSD she hoped to cure, Carrie had no trouble blocking out the memory of Abington's assault. She was focused on the task, summoning not only her recent training, but her years of residency work as well. As she prepared to drill the burr holes, Carrie thought back to the time not long ago when Beth Stilwell's life had rested in her hands. Today's procedure was technically a breeze by comparison. Acting as the team's neurophysiologist, Dr. Finley was in the operating room to record the electrical discharge patterns from nerve cells when Carrie worked the electrode ever so slowly toward the basolateral nucleus of the amygdala. Intraoperative neurophysiological monitoring was a demanding discipline, and obtaining certification required years of additional study. Carrie was impressed by Dr. Finley's dedication to his calling. There was no question that the doctor brought world-class medical skill to the VA. In addition to Dr. Finley and Dr. Kaufman, the team included Dr. R.T. Patel, a first-year neurological resident. Though Patel was primarily there to observe, he was also scrubbed, should Carrie require any unforeseen assistance. Intracranial hemorrhaging remained Carrie's chief concern during the operation, and post-op, she would be vigilant about monitoring for signs of infection. Also present was Donna Robinson, the scrub nurse, who looked of an age to have treated vets from Vietnam, and Louise Phillips, who, as a circulating nurse, was not scrubbed. Carrie doubted she'd find anybody quite like Valerie on the VA staff, but she was quite optimistic about the skill and diligence of these women and hoped over time to develop a rapport with her new colleagues. The real art of DBS work was developing leadership and communication skills in order to bring the team along with her during each operation. Fortunately, though everyone made it clear he was loved and missed, she sensed no lingering resentment over her replacing Sam Rockwell. For what it was worth, during scrub, Donna expressed her admiration for Carrie's toughness and grit. Hours ago, Carrie had been afraid for her life, but instead of retreating, she had brushed off the experience like a kid after a playground tumble. Having spent most of her career working for the VA, Donna measured a person by their ability to endure. Carrie attached the stereotactic frame to Steve Abington's shaved head with four screws, using a local anesthetic just to be sure, even though he had already been sedated. Then he was wheeled next door, where an MRI dedicated exclusively to OR protocols had been waiting, and a series of ultra-thin-cut T1 and T2 weighted images of his brain were acquired. Abington was wheeled back to the OR while the scans were loaded onto the planning station. Computer images provided exact XYZ coordinates of Abington's amygdala, giving Carrie all the information she would need to guide the stimulating electrodes to her target by the least invasive path. This sort of equipment would have prevented the Leon Dixon disaster, Carrie thought ruefully. It was a supremely expensive setup, and she wondered how much of the bill DARPA was covering. Probably most of it. Dr. Kaufman kept Abington unconscious with propofol and fentanyl. He would add isoflurane if deeper sedation became required. With Parkinson's and dystonia patients who had to be awakened intermittently in order to assess their motor function, agents like propofol were ideal. But the last thing anyone needed was another violent outburst during surgery, so it was best to keep this patient insensate. Carrie made a curvilinear right precoronal scalp incision and penetrated the underlying skull with the Midas Rex, making a standard 14-millimeter burr hole. A stim lock was screwed in. The electronic drive system was attached to the frame, and Carrie sliced open the dura. Next, the long metal cannula, guided by the drive platform, was ever so slowly introduced through the brain. Carrie took her time. She made certain the drive plane avoided any sulcus where some juicy artery or vein might be lurking. Carrie inched the cannula another millimeter forward. She checked her computer and inched it some more. Long minutes passed as Carrie meticulously worked the cannula toward the target area. By now, Carrie's legs ached, and a glossy sweat coated her brow and had to be dabbed away. The pull on her back left an unpleasant and persistent dull ache. As the hours passed, Carrie began to feel every stitch of Abington's assault. She blocked out the throbbing of her throat and the hurt in her shoulder from when she hit the floor. Her concentration had to be total, and it was. While this was still neurosurgery, it exercised a different set of muscles, which compounded Carrie's fatigue. She pushed, persevered, and tapped into the kind of mental toughness she'd taken up triathlons to build. At the start of the operation, Dr. Finley and others did frequent welfare checks with Carrie. Her two-word answer, "I'm fine," never varied, so the last check had come more than an hour ago. 3 hours into the surgery, Carrie announced softly, "I'm pretty sure we're at ground zero." She removed the stylus and replaced it with 3 micro-recording electrodes.
"Wow, I'm getting an excellent signal," said Dr. Finley. "I'm getting a typical pattern of neuronal firing from the basolateral amygdaloid nucleus. Great job, Carrie. You're right on target with the first pass. The anatomical and physiological coordinates could not be more perfect."
The microelectrodes were replaced by the stimulating electrode, and its surrounding stylet was removed. Carrie placed on the locking clip. All that was left would be to tunnel the exposed lead component into the chest. 4 hours had ticked off the clock. Abington was shifted onto his left side. The right side of his neck and chest were bathed in betadine. Carrie made an incision in the scalp and another 5-centimeter cut in the right side of his chest, just under the collarbone. Carrie inserted her fingers to enlarge a pocket where the subcutaneous pulse stimulator would fit. Then she inserted a T-tunneler and pushed it under the scalp and through the neck to reach the chest wound. The exposed lead was next introduced through the tunneler and connected to the generator in the chest. The scalp and chest were closed. The system was now in place and potentially operational. 5 hours of surgery were complete. Abington would spend the night in neuro recovery. Then it was home, wherever that was, and back in 3 weeks to follow up with Dr. Finley, who would assume the responsibility for adjustments of the stimulus generator signal. Dr. Finley checked the signal readings once more.
"Dr. Bryant, you've just hit a grain of rice in a 3-pound mass of jello. Congratulations."
Carrie removed her mask and grinned. Chapter 19. During the day, the canteen in the basement of the VA hospital buzzed with activity. But at this late hour, it was a ghost town. Food service stopped at 3 o'clock for everything except K-cup coffee and whatever the vending machines supplied. Food at the VA was partly subsidized by the government, which could explain why there was no dinner service for the staff. Carrie had slipped on a fresh pair of scrubs and joined Dr. Finley at a long table. Steve Abington was in neuro recovery and, Carrie figured, emerging from the effects of anesthesia about now. She could enjoy a cup of coffee and then go check up on her first and most eventful DBS patient. Dr. Finley was all smiles.
"Carrie, that was just splendid. You were like a veteran in the OR. No pun intended."
Carrie's face lit up with a genuine smile, and she blew on her coffee to cool it. "Thanks, I appreciate the compliment."
"The microelectrodes are perfectly placed," he continued, "right in the basolateral nucleus of the amygdala. The neuronal firing pattern, the post-op CT, everything's perfect. You were so calm and focused. I knew you could do this work."
"It was a team effort, like you said it would be."
"Ha, a modest neurosurgeon. Now that might be a first."
"One small step for Carrie Bryant. One hopefully enormous leap for Staff Sergeant Steve Abington."
Given all that you've been through, and I don't just mean the attack, what you did today was nothing short of astonishing. I really can't say enough good to you, Carrie.
Carrie tried to keep her composure, but blushed at his praise. She'd fought so hard to find her way back to her field, she was amazed to be here. Now, given the extent of her day, Carrie figured she'd be bone-weary, but it was the opposite. Maybe she'd crash later, but for the moment, Carrie felt electrified. After about 20 minutes talking about DBS, the surgery, and Abington's prospects for recovery, Dr. Finley glanced at his wristwatch.
Whoa, it's after 8. I mean, I love this place, but I gave up on the idea of using any hospital as a bunkhouse back in my residency years. So, will I see you tomorrow?
Dr. Finley winked. It was his way of asking if Carrie was coming back. Given the threat to her life, it was a reasonable question.
You couldn't keep me away, Carrie said with a smile. Well, no more unaccompanied consultations, Dr. Finley said. We need our best DBS surgeon safe if we're going to fix the PTSD problem one patient at a time.
Carrie saluted. Dr. Bryant will be reporting for duty, sir. Dr. Finley chuckled as he stood. The crow's feet marking the corners of his eyes seemed to have deepened.
We're lucky. You're both resilient and dedicated. But I suggest you go home and get some rest. It's been an eventful day.
Carrie nodded. You go on ahead. I'm going to nurse this coffee a while longer and catch up on some emails. Dr. Finley gathered his briefcase and gave Carrie's shoulder a couple of friendly pats before heading for the door. Carrie sipped her drink and watched him go. She took in the quiet. It was one of her favorite times to be at a hospital. At community, Carrie had been responsible for a whole team of patients, any of whom might turn for the worse at a moment's notice, and too often did. She had always been grateful for any 15-minute respite. Maybe this job would be a stepping stone back into other types of neurosurgery, but maybe not. Her mother preached mindfulness, living in the moment. Carrie was not opposed to the idea of making a long-term commitment here. Perhaps after she spoke with Abington, once Carrie could see the impact the procedure had made. A Don McCall miracle, it would encourage her transition to becoming a career DBS surgeon. Carrie laughed at herself as she got up to throw her coffee cup away. Who knew how long Carrie would last at the VA? Hell, she was happy just to be back in the OR. But the same ambition that drove Carrie into neurosurgery had climbed back up into the driver's seat of her mind. From now on, Carrie would focus just on her patients. She'd barely started this job. She needed to be here a while and experience the whole program before making any decisions. Best to get her head on her task. And right now, that was checking up on Steve Abington before checking out for the day. This crazy day. Even though Carrie functioned as an attending physician, her instinct was to go see her patient post-op. It had been ingrained in her for the past 4 years. One of the attending's privileges was being able to do the surgery and lead the scut to the residents. But Carrie was still a resident in both her heart and mind, and so a check on Abington was almost like a reflex. Steve Abington might well have taken Carrie's life, but he had also been instrumental in giving back her career. Inside the elevator, Carrie pressed 3 and headed up to the neuro recovery floor. The hall outside the elevator was dim, quiet, and empty as she walked down to the 4-bed unit. Hospitals could be lonely places in the evenings, but the VA seemed especially dormant. Carrie pushed the intercom and waited for the double doors to buzz open. Inside, 3 of the 4 glassed-in rooms were empty. Steve Abington was in the bed at the far end of the last room, extubated and resting comfortably, reclining with his head up 15 degrees. IV in place, a bedside gooseneck lamp illuminating his face. Mary Ann, the full-figured night nurse, sat behind a wide desk with her face buried in a book. In front of Mary Ann was a row of monitors, all dark except for the one reporting Abington's heart rate and BP. Taped to a wall in the nurse's station, easy to read from a distance, was a list of phone extensions for ordering various tests. As if Carrie needed another reminder she did not belong on the floor, at the bottom of the list, in bold lettering, was Evan Navarro's ordering number, as well as his username and password to the system where lab orders and such were entered. This was clearly his domain.
It's all quiet tonight.
Marianne spoke in a reedy voice, alert to her surroundings, despite keeping her eyes on her book, A Bodice Ripper Romance. Carrie grabbed Abington's chart and walked toward his bed.
I'm not used to seeing docs up here at this hour, Marianne called out. Usually I just call them if things go bad, and they usually don't with these DPS folks. Anesthesia extubates them and they breathe just fine. Haven't had a problem yet. Hey, you new here?
Carrie came back to the desk. With a smile, she extended her hand. I'm Dr. Carrie Bryan. I work with Dr. Finley. I'm the new DBS surgeon. Abington's hospital room held little warmth. With a crush of high-tech gear and monitors, the place was intimidating at best, and not intended for long-term stays. The electric hum of equipment buzzed, and in the quiet of the floor, every beep could be heard in perfect clarity. Carrie paused at the door and eyed her attacker with compassion. She reminded herself that the man who hours ago had his hands wrapped around Carrie's throat was not the same person who lay on this hospital bed. The image of Abington's crazed-eye look flashed through her mind and sent a chill down her spine. She could recall every detail of the attack, the feeling of pressure on her throat, the coursing terror as her windpipe closed, the smell of his hot breath when he hovered over her, his eyes aglow. But it wasn't with hate, was it? It had been fear. Yes, Abington was terrified when he attacked. In a way, the assault was more like a drowning person flailing at a would-be rescuer. She went to Abington's bedside and pulled a penlight from her coat pocket. "Good evening, Mr. Abington," Carrie said. "I'd like to check your pupils. Would you kindly follow my light?" Steve Abington opened his eyes ever so slowly and stared vacantly toward his doctor. If he remembered Carrie and what he'd done to her, it did not register on his face. Carrie quickly checked his pupillary reactivity and then his eye movements. "Now, please follow my light. Up, good, left, right, good." Abington's shaved head was dressed in bandages, but the stereotactic frame had been removed, and he looked handsome now that he was free of the elaborate computerized apparatus. "Well, you've had quite a day. We haven't had a proper introduction. Do you remember anything about meeting me?" Abington, who appeared quite groggy still, didn't respond. Carrie checked his reflexes and made sure he was moving all fours pretty much equally. "You were extremely upset when they brought you in," Carrie said. "Do you remember? You were very confused, telling me you didn't belong here." Abington mumbled something under his breath. He looked utterly lost and alone. Confusion smoldered in his darting eyes. "Steve, can you tell me the last thing you remember?" Like a veil had been lifted, Abington came alive and looked wildly about. His jaw set and a snarl overtook his face. He covered his ears with his hands and began to shake his head as if something was lodged inside his ears. Carrie worried he would rip the IVs out of his arm.
"Enough. Shut up, shut up, shut up," Abington said.
His speech came out thickly. His expression was that of a cornered animal. "Steve, what's wrong? What's going on?" Abington continued to turn his head frantically from one side to the other, keeping his hands over his ears.
"Where are you? Stop it. Stop saying that. Follow my light. Follow my light. Follow my light. What light? What light? Stop it."
"Steve, calm down. You've got to calm down. Everything is all right." Abington appeared to have heard Carrie, but his expression became even more agitated.
"Why do you keep saying it's all right? Nothing is all right. Nothing is all right. Nothing is all right. Stop saying that."
Abington flipped onto his stomach and buried his head under the pillow, but Carrie could hear him muttering the same words over and over.
"Follow my light. Follow my light."
Carrie bolted for the door. It would be easy to get Abington sedated. The question was, could she ever get him cured? Chapter 20. The badge dangling from a red lanyard identified the nurse as Lee Taggart. He wore crisply pressed white scrubs and unblemished matching canvas sneakers that carried him down the long hallway at a brisk pace.
He stopped in front of Marianne's workstation and leaned forward, hoping to catch her eye.
Reading anything good?
Lee's warm voice drew Marianne's attention. When she looked up, he flashed her a brilliant smile. Marianne smiled back. Lee had an athletic body and smooth ebony skin, and was not unaccustomed to flattering looks. He had never met Marianne before, but that was not so unusual here. Staff seemed to change as often as shifts, and Marianne would need only to see the red lanyard and white uniform to believe he was a staff nurse. Marianne glanced down at the cover of her book, which featured a bare-chested Adonis riding a stallion with a scantily clad buxom woman clutched in his massive arms. She laughed flirtatiously.
"Oh, just something to pass the time," she said, embarrassed enough to cover the book jacket with a clipboard.
The look in Lee's brown eyes turned conspiratorial.
"Another slow night, huh?" he said.
He knew it had not been slow in the least. Everything that could have gone wrong with Abington had gone wrong.
"I prefer that to the alternative," Marianne said as she glanced at one of the dark monitors and caught a glimpse of her reflection within.
She noticed her hair was a bit tousled, which she promptly corrected, using her hand as a comb.
"Well, I got assigned to Dr. Goodwin's staff tonight," Lee said.
"Just gotta go in and check on the patient. He's in 4, right?"
"That's right, he's in 4.
Marianne was having a heck of a time keeping her eyes off this new nurse. She was also struggling with Tinder and every other dating site where she'd posted a profile. The VA offered slim pickings when it came to the opposite sex, so she was enjoying this pleasant surprise to the fullest. Before Lee headed off to room 4, Marianne checked Abington's vitals in the only active monitor. His heart and pulse were optimal, but the patient had been in a blissful haloperidol stupor for the past couple of hours, with not a peep since his earlier outburst. She had been told to be extra vigilant for any QT prolongation or incidents of arrhythmia, but so far, he and the drug were working well together. Dr. Bryant had ordered 10 milligrams of diazepam 4 after Abington went crazy, and Marianne had bolted from her chair and gotten the syringe promptly. Within a few minutes, the patient was relaxed again, and his eyes closed.
"Looks like he didn't need too much on top of that residual anesthesia," Dr. Bryant had said.
Having had enough excitement for one night, Marianne had been satisfied with that explanation, but Dr. Bryant still looked perplexed.
"I've never seen anything like that," she said. "It's like he was hallucinating, hearing voices, the same phrase over and over again. He repeated what I said, and then he answered my question multiple times. I only said it once, but somehow it never stopped for him."
Marianne was not concerned.
"They're all agitated in some way," she said, not sharing Carrie's concern. "It's not unusual for them to get extra sedation. The residents are used to it, and they're trained for it, so I can see why it was a shock to you."
Marianne's words did not seem to have much impact on the new DBS surgeon. Dr. Bryant wrote a PRN sedative order, administer as needed. She told Marianne to call if there was a problem and to give the phone number to her relief at the 11 o'clock shift change. Sam Rockwell used to do the same. Marianne had looked in on Abington twice since then. He seemed a bit restless, his limbs moving involuntarily, shaking, but those were common side effects of the sedative.
"He's been a handful, that's for sure," Marianne said to Nurse Taggart. "Very agitated. Not sure what's going on with him."
"Well, that's why I'm here to check up on things."
"If he starts to give you trouble, you just holler," Marianne said.
"I sure will," Lee replied. "But I'm pretty good at handling almost any situation on my own."
With a wink, Lee headed to Abington's room. Marianne focused her gaze on his well-defined backside as he walked away.
"I bet you are."
She smiled and went back to her book.
Relentless heat bathed the back of Abington's neck, and sandy grit somehow wormed underneath his eyelids to scratch at his corneas.
Place? Time? Where was he? What had happened?
Somewhere off in the distance, Abington heard the thunderous roll of artillery shells detonating as the ground beneath him rumbled and shook with each massive blast. He felt around for his weapon, but his arms responded spastically like they had a mind of their own. One of Abington's pawing hands felt something made of steel. He clutched his M16 and pulled the weapon close to him. He managed to get onto his hands and knees, but each breath came at a price. Something was wrong. Something was horribly wrong with him. The air parted as bullets whizzed overhead. Abington forced open his eyes and blinked in response to the oppressive sunlight. When his vision cleared, he saw he was still in Afghanistan. Again, he was back where it all began, inside the foxhole, and Roach was with him just as before. Only now, the indestructible Roach had had his guts ripped open by a peppering of bullets and he was bleeding out. In lumbering, agonizingly slow motion, Abington flipped onto his belly and crawled over to his wounded comrade. He could not understand why his movements were so labored, dreamlike. But this could not be a dream. It was all too real. He could feel the heat scorching his skin, and a stench of gunpowder mixed with blood was visceral and genuine. Gasping, Abington made his way toward Roach, who groaned and clutched at his injured stomach. If Abington did not stop the bleeding soon, his friend would die, all over again. From close by, Abington heard a spit of gunfire. In the same instant, sand and dirt sprayed his face. With a burst of surprising adrenaline, Abington brushed his face clean and lurched forward, landing almost on top of Roach. With nothing to stop the bleeding, Abington placed his hands over the pulsing wound. He cried out in horror as his fingers sank deep inside the bloody cavity. Muscles and tendons pulsed around Abington's probing fingers, but the blood continued to ooze out. Roach moaned deliriously, fading in and out of consciousness. Abington was about to scream for a medic when he noticed a shadow looming. He looked up just in time to see the figure of a man leap into the foxhole with them. Abington blinked to clear his vision. He had thought the dark-skinned man was wearing white hospital scrubs, but now there were no scrubs. The man was dressed in camouflage, with the combat medic's Red Cross insignia sewn onto his sleeve.
"What's happening here, Steve?" the man asked.
Abington had so much to say, but he could not utter a single word. Instead, the medic's voice tumbled about his head, and Abington heard the words, "What's happening? What's happening? What's happening?" like a scratched record. Abington pulled his hands from the gruesome gut wound and covered his ears to try and block out the sound. His red-stained palms lathered his face with warm blood, but those words kept rolling about his head like an endless echo. "What's happening? What's happening? What's happening?"
"Steve, you're going to feel a little funny in a moment. Steve, you're going to feel, Steve, you're going to feel, Steve, you're going to feel."
"Stop! Stop saying that! Just fix Roach!"
Now it was Abington's voice providing the echo.
"Fix Roach! Fix Roach! Fix Roach!"
The medic moved inches from Abington's face as he produced a syringe full of clear liquid from his pocket. At first, the medic appeared to be injecting the syringe into thin air, but Abington's vision altered, and he saw the needle had penetrated the tubing of his own intravenous line. How did he get a line in his arm when it was Roach who had been shot?
"It's called potassium chloride, and while it's not fatal, you're going to feel very uncomfortable," the medic whispered benevolently. "I'll see you in a minute, Steve."
The medic climbed out of the foxhole and was gone, but not his voice, which remained and echoed mercilessly in his ears.
"I'll see you in a minute, see you in a minute, in a minute."
Seconds later, a new sensation came over Abington, something strange and unnerving. He inhaled sharply and fought against the tightness in his chest, curling into a fetal position and rhythmically rocking. He rubbed Roach's blood all over his head, hair, and neck in an effort to stop the noise in his head. Nearby, Roach lay on his back, mouth open, with a dead-eyed gaze up to the heavens. The tightness changed into something else. Abington's heartbeat began to flutter, then it morphed into a pounding. Abington could feel the palpitations in his chest, throat, and neck. He turned his head and locked his gaze on his dead friend, certain he would soon be joining him. Lee Taggart had made it to the elevator bank when Abington's alarm went off. While he was not at all surprised, Lee still made a show of it and raced back to Marianne, who had a look of panic on her face. Some of the nurses were stoics. They could handle any stressful situation thrown at them, while others were not at all adept at managing crises. They tended to relish the relative calm of the neuro recovery floor.
"Something is wrong," she said. "His heartbeat just went crazy."
"He's on haloperidol, right?" Lee said. "Arrhythmia can be a side effect. I'm here. Let me rush him down to the med ICU."
Marianne looked relieved. She was definitely not the good in emergencies type.